just to give you a brief breakdown on amphibians and some issues that they're dealing with and how this will impact you if you're involved with the pet trade or any other way that upcoming legislation is sure to come down the pipe and can affect all of us, including at the research level. Just some basic stuff. There's over 7,000 described species of amphibians right now, and at least a third of them are in serious trouble. When I say serious trouble, definitely on the decline and headed towards extinction. Of the remaining two-thirds, at least a third of those are data deficient, meaning we don't know, and chances are a lot of those are in trouble. That's a big number because we started with 7,000. Some estimates suggest that at least 200 species already have gone extinct, and most of this has kicked up in the past 25 years, at least that we know about. And I wanted to point this out here. I don't think the scope of this problem is clear to most folks. If you were to take all of the world's endangered birds, all of the world's endangered mammals, and now you can add in all of the world's endangered freshwater fish, that's still not the same number of species of amphibians that are headed towards extinction. So we're talking about a very large number of animals going that direction. Now, just a few dates that are important here. In the early 1980s, research biologists started taking note that things were disappearing. At the World Congress in 1989, there were some murmurs of problems in the field. But then, by 1990 and 1997, there were a lot of researchers saying, hey, look, in my field site, the entire community has disappeared. We're not talking about one or two species disappearances. In the tropics, you can start with a community of amphibians that can range from 50 all the way on up to 85 amphibian species, and in 3 months' time, you can be down to less than 10. So that's the scale of disappearance we're talking about. And then, so by 97, there were regular workshops being held on this stuff, and now in 2005, the Amphibian Conservation Summit took place. That resulted in some papers and some amphibian conservation action plan comments that were directed at what we can do. Some hypotheses really quickly behind what's going on. Habitat alteration undoubtedly is involved here. 90% of all species that are in trouble suffer also from habitat loss. So right off the bat, we don't even have to evoke a pathogen explanation for this. Habitat alteration is serious. But habitat alteration, a lot of folks don't realize, it doesn't mean you have to go in and cut the forest down. There's a lot of other things you can do that can impact reptiles and amphibians in just as negative a way. For example, you can put a road through a forest, and you can do nothing else to the forest, and you can wipe species out very, very quickly. If you happen to bisect a pathway where an amphibian lives in its breeding ground, a reproductive area, this is an endangered red-legged frog. She was filled with eggs before she got run over by the car. Harvest is something that can definitely impact amphibian populations. I'm not hanging this on any one group. I'm just saying harvest for food, harvest for medicine, and harvest for scientific collection, and the pet trade. Any of those can impact amphibian populations. I'm not saying that there's any specific example there where one plays in heavier than the others. Exotic species are really impacting a lot of amphibians, including serving as predators, serving as competitors, and then native species serving as prey items. Ultraviolet light exposure, there's a lot of research that's gone into this. Whether or not it's really impacting a lot of amphibians is still pretty controversial. Most of the examples are at higher elevations, and again, the evidence really isn't conclusive. Acid rain certainly impacts things like salamander because it acidifies our waters and our soils. Environmental contaminants, whether we're talking about pesticides, heavy metals, or fertilizers, all of those things can change the equation against amphibians. But emergent infectious disease, where this plays in today, the big one that everybody talks about now is chytrid fungus, but definitely, as was mentioned earlier, arytoviruses are important in bacterial epidemics. And we can get into some of those others if you'd like to talk about them, but the last group here that I want to mention are synergistic interactions, where you can have fertilizer introduced at high elevation waterways, and when you couple that with UV exposure, the net mortality observed is higher than either of those two would have done individually. And likewise, fertilizer and arytovirus, when you have fertilizer in a waterway and rid of virus, some, you know, that one of those epidemics comes into play, you can have a much greater mortality than either one of those events would have been predicted to have had at the start. And likewise, climate change and chytrid fungus. So, let's see. I'm going to stop right there. I just wanted to put those slides up. I want to give you just a very brief notion of where scientists or scientific thinking is right now with chytrid fungus. It's still a very controversial issue. And the problem is, we have not had a lot of time to look at this. The fungus involved was described in 97. So we're not talking about years and years and years of time to study this, and most of the outbreaks have happened again in the past 25 years. So science can't even agree as to where it really started. And you hear some arguments or some hypotheses that it started in Africa and it came out with something like African aquatic clawed frog, Xenopus, right? They were shipped all over the world years and years ago for a huge diversity of things, ranging from pregnancy testing in humans. A lot of people know we use rabbits. A lot of folks don't know we use frogs. Environmental toxicology studies in labs, the pet trade. There's all kinds of reasons that African clawed frogs were shipped all over the world. They're aquatic. You have them in aquariums. What does everybody do that has an animal in an aquarium? You change the water at some point. Put it in the drain, it goes down the drain, it goes to the local waterway. There is an aquatic stage of that particular pathogen. If it gets into the local waterway, you could have moved that pathogen into the local amphibian community. So for a long time, folks were thinking, okay, wait, you know, we don't see a lot of these epidemics in Africa. We've seen a couple isolated instances, but chances are it came out of Africa. But now there's folks coming forward. They have found very old preserved specimens of Japanese giant salamanders that had the fungus present in its skin. And likewise, just at the Vancouver World Congress herb meetings, there were Brazilians that came out, and they have now identified amphibian chytrid fungus in the skin of specimens from the Atlantic forest, the Brazilian coast, that date back from 1890. So the pet trade and movement of clawed frogs at that point was not in play. And that's not where that would have come from. And there are a lot of folks arguing now that it was actually pan-global, but what we've done is we've moved certain strains around. And this is where epidemiology comes into play. And it's just, if you put it in a simpler context with people, you can have a cold go around that if all of us got it, we would all respond. We could all, most of us could respond similarly. A few of us wouldn't, right? It would hit us a little stronger or a little weaker. The same thing may be playing out here, we don't know. Or there could, for whatever reason, be particular strains that were in places like Africa or Southeast Asia. We did move it around through whatever means, and they hit naive populations that may have had another strain of chytrid fungus, but they had co-evolved with that strain, and you don't run into the issues. Now you've got another more virulent strain coming in, and you've got all kinds of issues. I'm not saying any one of these pathways is the answer. What I'm saying is that it's still very contentious in the scientific community, and we certainly don't have all the answers. The unfortunate thing is this is all playing out so fast. By the time we do have the answers, a lot of this might be done and gone. Just remember, this is no different from humans. I always like to put it in a human context because a lot of people are naturally going to shift that way with their thinking. So what happened when the Europeans came over and they started exploring the Americas? They brought all their diseases with them. What happened to the Amerindians? They got all these diseases, and you had huge die-offs from things like syphilis and even the common cold and the flu viruses. Those kinds of things happen just the same with wildlife. There's no difference. And we could have very, very lightly moved something from point A to point B. It could have been through the pet trade, but it may not have been. It could have been through some sort of research activity. It could have been something like moving frogs around for pregnancy testing. So we don't know, but unfortunately right now this is happening so quickly. It's a shame to see. Yeah.
Any populations develop resistance?
That's a great question. Have any populations developed resistance? There are two ways of looking at that. In Australia right now, there's a big study going on with a frog that quite literally disappeared from the wild, owing directly to chytridiomycosis. One of the points was you have to make the difference between the disease and the pathogen that can cause it. So chytrid fungus causes it. The actual disease itself is chytridiomycosis. And all of the frogs of this species and at the few localities where they were known in Australia had disappeared from the wild. They had brought in assurance colonies, they bred them in captivity to huge numbers, and they tried something that nobody else had tried before. They tried just deluging the old localities with captive-produced animals. 99% of them were dying, but less than a percent were hanging on, and now they've actually reestablished a population, and they don't know what the mutation is. There's something in that very, very small subset of frogs that does allow them to hold on, and certainly I can give you a million examples of things here that are resistant to it. For example, bullfrogs are carriers. They have amphibian the fungus that causes amphibian kindred fungus on their skin, but they don't actually show any signs of contributing mycosis. They don't move into having that disease even though the pathogen is present. And I can give you a lot of examples of that. And incidentally, that's one of the problems and why it's so tough to deal with this in the wild. We would actually be far better off if when it went through an amphibian community, it wiped everything out, rather than one or two species hanging on, living just fine with it and carrying out on the skin. If it would wipe everything out, we could take assurance colonies in, let it sweep through the habitat, everything dies out, the pathogen disappears, and then you put things back. But we don't have a single example of where that's happened in the wild. There's always one or two hangers on, right? So you look at a place like El Cope or El Valle of Panama, when amphibian kindred fungus went through there, you started with something on the order of 53 to 57 species of amphibians that were described. I'm sure there were a lot of other things. And then a kindred fungus swept through, and in about 4 months' time, we dropped down to about 7 species. So, and they're carriers. And, you know, it's present on our skin. PCR had been mentioned, it's a polymerase chain reaction. It's a really easy way to look for the DNA of amphibian kindred fungus. All the species that are still there are carrying it. You know what? The difficulty with that is the specimens are so old. I'm going to work under the assumption that they were just collected live, looking relatively healthy out of the wild, and were preserved and sent into museum collections. They weren't preserved because they were sick. At least there's no records indicating that. And so I have to assume that they were simply animals that were collected from the wild and ended up in museum collections. Now we know what to look for. They can go back in these old specimens and they can look at the skin and they can figure out whether or not there was a certain other fungus present. So that I just wanted to give you a quick update. And again, it's really convoluted. I wish I had answers for you. I don't think anybody could give you answers on this right now. There's a lot of discussion. There are a lot of hypotheses out there, and a lot of folks who don't agree on even where this thing is. Well, you know, it's a great question. So the question is, should you ban movement of amphibians in the commercial trade? Just chop a petri dish and say you don't live no more bass. Look, this is just my personal opinion. I'm not a lawmaker. I'm a research biologist, and I look at it from the other end, and I don't have a dog in the sun. But I will tell you this much. Having read the literature and watched what's happened, if we were going to do that, if as a society we were going to sit back and say it's time to ban the amphibian trade because we're worried about moving these things around, they needed to do that 50 years ago, not now. What that is sitting back and watching a building burn down and then standing up, pulling out a fire extinguisher and saying, shit, we should have had a couple of these around. It's ridiculous, and it's not going to do anything for anybody at this point. It is where it's going to be.
Just to let you guys know, it is 3:00.